terrible. Every Saturday at 6 a.m., it's the Inner Kid Radio Hour on KPFT.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, and occasional counterfoil is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just a reminder, there is a May 9th election which you may or may not have a ballot for, so you really need to go to your election clerk, wherever, if it's Harris County, it's harrisvotes.com. Otherwise, you can go to our blog post, and I have, I believe, links to all of the adjacent county election clerks or county clerks.
And you can always fall back on votetexas.gov.
And you can always fall back on votetexas.gov, where you can find a sample ballot if there is one for your specific address, your specific precinct. Early voting, if you have something to vote for, begins on April 24th, and I will try to keep you posted. And, of course, there's always election information at the top of my blog post. Okay, we will be talking about local, state, and other news after this story, but I consider this kind of a public service announcement, not just about car buying, but about credit building more generally. So bear with me, please. The story is from Michelle Singletary, from the Washington Post. Car payments are $1,000 a month for a lot of consumers, and here's why. And the story goes on. The average price of a new vehicle is now $47,680, and the cost of financing has gotten considerably higher because of the Federal Reserve's fight to beat back inflation. The average interest rate for a new vehicle loan was 7% in the first quarter, compared with 4.4% in the same quarter a year earlier. That is the highest level since 2008, according to new data from Edmunds, a car shopping website. For used vehicles, the average jumped from 7.8% for a loan to 11.1%. That's per year. How does that translate into monthly payments? It's shockingly high. There were lots of new highs in the Edmunds data, which is based on aggregated information from hundreds of thousands of transactions each month at dealerships across the country. The average monthly payment for a new vehicle hit a record, this is the average now, $730 a month in the first quarter, up from $656 the same quarter last year. And about 16.8%, or one in six, are paying $1,000 or more a month, also a new all-time high. If that weren't bad enough, a lot of car buyers are rolling old loans into new car finance deals. In February, 44.2% of new vehicles purchased had a trade-in, and 18% of those trade-ins had negative equity. In housing terms, they were underwater or upside down, meaning they owed more on the car than it was worth. Said Jessica Caldwell, Edmunds Executive Director of Insights, most Americans, let's be honest, don't pay cash any longer. They take out loans, and that has made car buying very expensive. Here are five money-saving tips, some of which I've abbreviated. You can go to the full article at thinkwingradio.com if you're in the market for a vehicle right now. First, shop around for your financing, not just your car. Comparison shopping for financing is critical. Don't settle for what a dealer may offer. Check with your bank or credit union. Line up financing before setting foot on a car lot. If the dealer can match what you've secured elsewhere, that's fine, but at least you know if what they are offering is competitive. Next, go for a shorter term loan. They give you the same advice, by the way, for buying a house, a 15-year note, but of course the payments are higher. The average loan term now for a new car in the first quarter was about 70 months. Now, the maximum they'll permit is typically 72. A rule of thumb when it comes to auto loans, if you can't afford the monthly payment with 48-month financing, you're probably buying above your means, because otherwise you're going to end up with a 7-year-old car that you still owe money on. Look for financing deals. With rates rising, Edmunds has seen an increase in lower-cost financing offers from automakers. Instead of offering cash back for a particular vehicle, the dealer might alternatively have a financing promotion. Caldwell said automakers are going to start subsidizing these loans because they need to move the metal. So you may see an offer for 3.9% or something a bit lower. I would encourage people, she said, to look for those types of programs. Last year it was a desert in terms of incentives, but those deals are often reserved for consumers with excellent credit histories. Improving your credit score, we're going to talk about that in more depth after this story. You may want to hold on to your older car while you work on boosting your credit score, which will put you in a better position to snag the best financing. The best way to increase your credit score is to pay your bills on time and reduce the amount of debt you're carrying. Buy a cheaper car. Be flexible. Maybe you just can't afford a new car or the exact make and model you've had your heart set on purchasing. With vehicle inventory still catching up to consumer demand, it's harder to negotiate the price of a newer used car. Couple that with rising interest rates on auto loans, and the best way to cut costs is to expand your search to a more affordable vehicle. There was something I was thinking of mentioning, but I'll go on. It'll come back to me. So this information in this article is really good information, and if you're shopping for a car or ever intend to shop for a car, reading it is worth doing by clicking on the link to the article provided at thinkwingradio.com. Also, as an older person with some perspective on this, I'd like to add some thoughts. First, when I was growing up, a 36-month car loan was common. It was actually the longest loan you could get on a car. You couldn't get more than 36 months on a new car. When it went to 48 months, I thought that was crazy. It blew my mind when I found out car loans had gone as long as 72 months and they weren't even low monthly payments. This is kind of a socio-political economic thing. It can easily be explained by the increases in the cost of cars, of course, especially with so many new technologies and features being standard. I mean, electric windows and, 30 years ago, it's like, forget it. But I would also argue that the problem is that wage growth in the same period has been suppressed, leading to cars becoming relatively more expensive compared to current wages. When it comes to borrowing money to buy a car or anything else for that matter, a loan payment, and I'm going to start with basics here, it's comprised mostly of principal and interest, otherwise known as P&I. A shorter loan increases the monthly payment, but decreases the final cost, in other words, the cost with interest. A longer loan might make for a more affordable monthly payment, but will significantly increase what you finally end up paying for the car and the loan. Every buyer has their monthly payment sweet spot. But when I've done the math, for example, for mortgages, I found that after a certain point, the longer loan doesn't significantly decrease your monthly payment, but can dramatically affect your final cost. So there is a line where those two numbers cross and it's no longer to your advantage. I strongly recommend you get a good calculating app, loan calculating app, to help you with this, or find someone who can, but don't try to get this from your dealer. When it comes to improving your credit score or first starting to build credit, there are a few tips I can offer. Consider using them in whatever order applies to you. First, have a checking account. If you don't have one, open one. This does not have to be expensive. There are many online banks that will allow you to open a checking account with a low or even zero minimum balance without monthly fees for maintaining a minimum balance. Another advantage is that these accounts usually let you pay bills online without a fee, without the cost of postage or service fees or physical checks. It can be a real money saver for the underbanked or the unbanked for that matter, and really just requires the knowledge and the will to do so. Interest rates vary. There are a lot of banks that even if they would normally charge a fee or require a minimum balance, if you can have direct deposit for your paycheck, you can qualify for a free checking account. It might help if you don't have one to apply for your first credit card, because you need to build a credit history. You can't live in this country without some kind of a credit history. The two easiest cards to get, and I'm not referring to debit cards or prepaid cards, are either from the bank where you have a checking account, like a Visa or MasterCard with, you know, maybe a limited initial credit, or store or gas card. Now, your first credit limit might be as low as $200 or $250, but that's okay. That's a start. Use your new card, but never revolve a charge. Pay your card debt in full by the due date on time each month. Your card is exactly like money. If you can't afford a purchase out of savings, don't buy it on a credit card. A common misconception is to revolve debt. Don't do that. Revolving debt doesn't make the credit card company like you better and give you a better credit rating or more credit. Revolving your debt, even if it's like a low debt, like you owe $100 and you decide to pay the minimum payment so the company makes money on you and they like you, it doesn't work that way. It's just the reverse. If you revolve a charge, the credit card company assumes you're stretching yourself beyond your immediate resources. It also adds interest at a very high rate, usually in the 25% or more range. I've seen cards charge 35% or more in some cases. Furniture cards, I think, are particularly bad about that. If you can't pay a card in full in a given month, pay as much as you can, not just the minimum payment. You want to discharge credit card debt as quickly as possible. It's even to some extent more important than saving money. It is the, and you've heard this from other credit advisors. Paying down credit card debt is the best way to save money.
And the less debt you actually have, the less money you're going to accrue in interest that you're then going to have to pay later, as far as
right.
I understand.
And I have, I mean, I'm very diligent with my finances. I have gotten to a point at one stage in my life, it was a very tough stage of my life, where I actually could no longer afford the minimum payment. And at that point, I had to go to family and borrow money. Mm. I had to close out an IRA because the penalty for closing an IRA early was still a better deal than paying the interest on the credit card.
Yep.
So, I mean, sometimes you've got to make some hard choices, but yep. The absolute most important thing to do, the most profitable thing to do, is to discharge credit card debt and don't have any. Mm. So there's that. Be careful with those no interest fixed time loans. These can be really tempting. The ones that like buy this furniture, no payments until January, and then no interest until the end of next year. You know, you've heard things like that. These can be very, very tempting and even helpful when buying large purchases like bedding or furniture or, you know, lawn equipment or tools. If a loan is not paid in full by the end of the free period, it is no longer interest-free. And the interest doesn't just start from where, you know, the year ends. All the interest you would have paid from the very beginning without the promotion is backcharged to the purchase debt at the normal card rate, which, as we've discussed, is going to be high. This can be a catastrophic result, resulting in a long-term debt trap. Even one or two late payments may result not only in late fees plus interest being backcharged, and also interest then charged going forward. It might even result in your loan balance being called in early, another potentially catastrophic result if you don't have the resources to pay it early. It would also be horrible for your credit score, which raises your interest on loans and may deny you the ability to borrow at all. If you have one of these no-interest loans, calculate the number of months without interest and divide that into the loan balance. So like if you have, let's say you have a $12,000 interest-free loan for 1 year. You divide 12 months into 12,000, that's $1,000 a month. So you want to be paying at least $1,000 a month so that the final month pays your debt in full. Do not make the minimum payment. That will not pay it in full, and you will end up with all this interest being brought back to the beginning. The best thing to do if you have one of these long-term no-interest loans, try to calculate it so you pay it in full a month early. So if you have a 12-month no-interest loan, try to pay it in full by the 11th month. And that way, if there's any kind of a difference. You know, you're off by a buck, you're off by a quarter, you're off by $3. You have another month to get that straight. Otherwise, believe me, they will penalize you. There is no forgiveness. Okay, Andrew, have I left anything out?
Well, I think you've covered most of it, but I actually have a tip for folks building or rebuilding their credit score. If you're going to make a small purchase that you know you have the money to cover, say you're buying a drink or you're buying a meal out somewhere, put it on your credit card instead of your debit card and pay that single charge off immediately. If the same bank manages both cards, this can be as simple as transferring money from your checking account straight to your credit card. This helps because your credit score is a representation of both how often you use your credit and how responsible you are with it. Small purchases that are always paid on time contribute to both frequency and responsibility. You may need to do this fairly often in order for it to have an appreciable difference. But if this is a habit you get into, I have been told by people I trust that it will help you.
Yeah, credit rating is a funny thing. You know, there was a time when having fewer cards meant you were more reliable because you weren't relying on loans. Now, it seems that having a lot of credit cards that you've had for years but don't use much, that means that the money that is pending, you're using a very small percentage of how much you could use, and that makes you a responsible borrower. And so they actually recommend to try to avoid closing credit card accounts. It changes your ratio. It will actually lower your score. I know it's insane.
Yeah, and the longer you have a line of credit open, that's the longer that your history can be. And so they can give it more weight from the fact that you've paid your, you know,
shows stability.
Yeah.
Also, another thing that my wife used to like to do, there was a card that we didn't use often, but it did offer us a 5% discount on the purchase for using the store card.
Right.
Now, because we didn't use it often, it was sometimes an easy bill to overlook paying, which then gets you into a different problem.
Yeah.
So what she did as a matter of routine is she would go to the cash register, take the 5% discount, go to the customer service counter, pay off the purchase.
Ah, okay.
So she would literally then charge the card for the discount and then pay cash at the service counter to pay off that receipt.
Right.
So we always had a zero balance when we got the bill. Simple way to save money, right? You just have to think to do it.
Yeah, and it's a similar strategy to what I suggested.
I've always had a lot of sympathy for the underbanked and the unbanked, and I've tried on an individual basis many times to help people that needed some guidance, needed some advice, needed a pathway. And I've been able to help a few people. You don't have to feel that you can't afford to have a bank account.
Yeah.
There are online banks where you can make a deposit with an initial deposit with no minimum balance that will allow you to pay bills online, that you can possibly get a credit card from them after you've had your checking account for like 6 months or a year if they see you're not like bouncing checks and stuff. There are strategies that people can use, and I wish more people knew them. And I wouldn't mind helping people if I can, to the extent I'm not a professional, but I mean I have life experience, and if someone wants to email me directly, I'll be happy to offer what advice I can, or if you want to perhaps write a comment on Facebook. And you know, we have ThinkWing Radio, Mike Honig at ThinkWing Radio on Facebook. And I can respond to a question there. I can't recommend anything on the show.
Right.
So that's kind of the pickle I'm in. Okay. Our next story will be about a funny thing happened on the way to Montgomery County's forensic facility. But first, you are listening to ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6. You can also hear the show online at kpft.org, download it with Google Podcasts, available from both the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for various versions, earlier versions of this and over 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt almost every single story, so I link to the full posts on my blog for each show at thinkwingradio.com. You can click on the Show Posts and More tab at the top of the webpage, find the post or the show you're looking for, Recent shows are usually at the top. Show articles go back, believe it or not, as far as May 2010. And you can type keywords into the search bar, and that will also turn up various episodes from recent or years ago. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. I am intermittently still on Twitter, or as Elon Musk has recently reincorporated it, X.
Huh.
Did you hear about that? Yeah.
I didn't.
It's no longer Twitter. It is literally, it's been subsumed into a wholly owned corporation as a subsidiary that is privately owned.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
It is officially called X Incorporated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so yes, you can still tweet me, but I might not get it right away. So at this point, either a direct email to thinkwingradio@msn.com or thinkwingradio on Facebook. Best way to try to reach me directly. And Andrew, of course, has his possibly less complicated ways of contacting him.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch. And now that we've had Mike's money moment, let's head to Montgomery County.
Yeah, let's just Uber over.
Mm.
Car, money, that. Okay, from communityimpact.com, Montgomery County needs $1.35 million to purchase land for the forensic center they've already built on what is apparently airport grounds. The Montgomery County Commissioner's Court must find a way to pay $1.35 million for the land on which the new center was built after the property was mistakenly identified as county property. This is kind of like the League City City Council Redux, right? Anyway, apparently the property actually belongs to the Conroe North Houston Airport, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. It should be knowledge to somebody in the county that when we are constructing a facility that is not aviation use on the airport grounds that we need approval to do. So prior to, and this is actually how it's quoted, and there's a fee involved for doing so. We have to buy the land at fair market, said Precinct 3 Commissioner James Nowick at an April 11th Commissioner's Court meeting. According to James Brown, the director of the Conroe North Houston Airport, the property on which the $13 million new forensic center was built at 9900 Carl Pickering Drive was thought to be county property, but it was later identified as airport property by the FAA and the Texas Department of Transportation. Brown said, I think it's challenging, too, because the land, if you were to go out there prior to being built, the land is separated by public roads, but it is designated as airport property. There was an airspace check done, and TxDOT and the FAA said, hey, wait, that's not aviation. You need to release it, Brown said. The money will not go to the FAA, but to the Conroe North Houston Airport budget, according to Brown. The item was ultimately tabled by the court to allow the Montgomery County Attorney's Office to figure out possible solutions to the land ownership issue and have more discussions with the FAA regarding possible alternate release agreements for the land. Maybe they can, rent out the forensic lab. I don't know. It's not like airlines never need it. The 22,000-square-foot forensic center was initially approved in 2020 after severe backlog in the previous forensic center led to delays in investigations and returns to relatives. The facility opened last October. Now, I seem to recall that this is the same facility we discussed a few months ago, where what they were actually discussing was whether their extra-portable mortuary facilities should go in the front of the building where they already had electrical connections built in, or to the back of the center, which was aesthetically more pleasing, but which they then would have had to rewire in order to run the temporary mortuaries.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, there were bigger issues to address, like who owned the land the facility was on. And I know this isn't funny, but it feels funny.
Oh, it's funny. It's just also extremely concerning. I mean, how does a county government not check if it owns the land it wants to build on before it starts building? How does nobody check while the building process is going on? This is a very large mistake, and I suspect any new build in Montgomery County will be met with whose land is it anyway, jokes
And double-check the ownership on that, will you?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's what we do title searches for.
Yeah. That's what we do title searches for. Yeah. Apparently Montgomery County doesn't.
Apparently they don't. Okay, our next story is from communityimpact.com. Pearland Police Department to receive new breaching equipment. The Pearland Police will soon have new breaching equipment to help better equip them to effectively respond to active shooter situations, not only at schools, but at other potential targets. On April 10th, Pearland City Council voted unanimously to award a supply of contracts to purchase breaching tools for every marked Pearland Police Department patrol vehicle from supply store Dana Safety Supply. The $53,480 contract will be used to purchase 120 crowbars and 80 sledgehammers. Following the May 2022 shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, the department conducted several self-assessments of their planned response for active shooter attacks. As part of the assessments, a six-person committee of current and former SWAT members identified equipment that allows for fast and effective response to an active shooter beyond the standard equipment issued to officers, according to agenda documents. The breaching tools are effective in that they not only are able to be carried by a single officer, but with proper training would enable officers to gain entry into the majority of barricade scenarios, according to the documents. Again, an excerpted article. Now, I'm not in a position to contradict former SWAT officers, but I'm trying to envision a scenario where an active shooter will politely wait while an officer tries to pry open a door with a crowbar. Now, a sledgehammer of sufficient weight and adequately wielded may be effective in this kind of crisis, but I hope the officers get plenty of practice beforehand with this kind of forced entry, because I suspect it's harder than it seems. Andrew?
Well, yeah, I agree that there was probably a better use for the money spent on those crowbars. Non-police spending is the first thing that comes to my mind, but setting that aside, I thought the main takeaway from the Uvalde shooting was that the police were too afraid of a shooter that they outnumbered and outgunned to go stop him. Now, I understand that fear can make people freeze up, but I would think that professional emergency responders would have training to act despite that fear. Maybe Pearland Police are perfectly fine on that front, but has anyone checked? I'm sure a refresher training course wouldn't do any harm, or de-escalation training. That could come in handy in all sorts of situations.
Periodic training and retraining is always good. I don't care whether you're an athlete or an executive or a mid-rank worker. Or a board operator at KPFT. We all, over time, you know, they always say go back to the basics. Mm-hmm. It sounds stupid, but sometimes that helps. You just start to cut steps because you're so accustomed to doing a thing a certain way. So, yeah, extra training, figuring out the best way to use that sledge to get the best result on a variety of different door types, whether they're wood or plywood or metal. It'll take some practice to learn the best way to wield this thing.
Yeah.
Okay, our next story is from the Texas Tribune. Texas House budgets $545 million for prison air conditioning. The Senate hasn't offered anything. Sweltering heat has killed inmates, driven away prison workers, and cost taxpayers millions in lawsuits. The House budget would provide air conditioning for 46 prisons, but it's unclear if the Senate will sign on. The Texas House committed $545 million to install the AC in many of the state's dangerously hot prisons. In a historic win for prisoners' rights advocates, who have long fought to cool prisons in a state where the relentless Texas heat has baked prisoners to death, likely contributed to severe staff shortages and cost taxpayers millions of dollars in wrongful death and civil rights lawsuits. More than two-thirds of Texas's 100 prisons don't have air conditioning in most living areas, forcing thousands of prison officers and tens of thousands of prisoners to work and live and sleep in stifling temperatures. But getting the funds included in the final House budget proposal is only half the battle. On the other side of the state capitol, the more conservative Senate has not set aside any money to install prison AC from the staggering $32.7 billion in extra funds the legislature has to work with this year. A Senate bill that would require prisons to be kept between 65 and 85 degrees, which is already law for local jails, has not yet had a hearing. An identical bill in the Republican-led House was voted out of committee unanimously. It's unfortunate that this battle is this difficult, said State Rep. Terry Canales, an Edinburgh Democrat who is leading the House bill and whose measure to cool prisons passed out of the House in 2021 without a hearing in the Senate. It's inhumane, he said, what we're doing. Canales said he planned to talk to senators this week seeking compromise. He placed the responsibility for the funding's final outcome squarely on the shoulders of Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the leader of the Senate who alone decides if and when to move legislation in his chamber. Patrick did not respond to questions about the proposed funding, nor did State Senator Joan Hoffman, the Republican chair of the powerful Senate Finance Committee. Every summer, as temperatures regularly soar into triple digits, prisoners and officers are cramped inside concrete and steel buildings without ventilation, save windows broken out of desperation and fans that blow hot, hot air. Before recently, it wasn't uncommon for prisoners to drop dead, with at least 10 Texas prisoners dying of heat stroke during the sweltering summer of 2011, according to court records. Facing a handful of wrongful death challenges and an expensive class action lawsuit at a geriatric prison, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, the TDCJ, took action. After years of court battles, the prison agency agreed to install air conditioning at the geriatric prison and shuffled men and women around to put many of its sick or elderly prisoners into cooler housing. I want to note that I don't think that the article mentions precisely the year the agreement was made. I think it implies around 2011. TDCJ heat deaths are likely undercounted, as scientists have found extreme heat is often overlooked as a cause of death. And with climate change expected to bring even hotter temperatures, prisoners, prison rights advocates, and union and officers' unions have desperately called for the state to action for years. The bill is not just about inmates. It's about hardworking men and women and staff, many of whom work 16 to 24 hours a day, 6 days a week, said Clifton Buchanan, a former corrections officer and deputy director of the Texas Correctional Employees Council, at a legislative hearing on Canales' bill last month. This year, with a large surplus in the legislature's checkbook, the House responded to the advocates' call. In its two main budget bills, funding current projects and those for the next 2 years, state representatives would put $545 million into cooling 46 of the 73 prisons that don't yet have air conditioning in all prisoner housing areas. The House said it intended to funnel more money in additional legislation sessions to follow a four-phase plan that would cool all prisons by 2031. The plan was developed by TDCJ after House Speaker Dade Phelan asked his committee appropriations for appropriations in 2021 to make funding recommendations for an incremental installation of air conditioning prisons in prisons. The first and second phases are included in the current House budget proposals. Phase one would cool 16 facilities by 2025, focusing on transfer facilities mainly, which hold newly sentenced prisoners and those with large special needs populations. Phase two would put air conditioning in another 30 facilities by 2027, focusing on larger prisons built in the 1980s and 90s. The two final phases are not included in the House funding this legislative session, which would cool the remaining 27 prisons. I have commented on this situation on other shows, this being an intolerable imprisonment environment. This time, the story made me think of a torture execution device called the Brazen Bull.
Hmm.
The Brazen Bull was designed, according to Wikipedia, in the form and size of an actual bull. The condemned were locked inside the device, and a fire was set under it, heating the metal until the person inside was roasted to death.
Jesus.
Un-air-conditioned prisons, which in any case are not designed for great air circulation, are really just another form of torture in a modern society. It's intolerable. That, even if the Texas Senate passes this bill this session, it will take until 2031, and I'm sure that's optimistically, to complete the job that is in itself inexcusably delayed.
Mm.
What also upsets me is that there's a recording, and I have to admit it's from John Oliver. The recording is apparently attributed to an interview in 2011 on a radio program, so I can't vouch for his still feeling this way. But John Whitmire of Texas Senatorial District 15 said in 2011 on a radio show, Democrat, that Texas can't afford to air-condition Texas prisons, and that we don't want to. The audio of this comment was played on HBO's Last Week Tonight in June 2021. I found that comment to be immensely disappointing. I've linked to the clip. As a footnote, John Whitmire is currently running for Houston mayor. Andrew?
Yeah, and specifically he was saying, we don't want to air-condition Texas prisons, as if he was including himself in that we. And that's
one of the other things he said is, if you want to be cool, don't go to prison.
Right, absolutely. And again, there is a link to that reference on the blog at thinkwingradio.com.
Yeah. At the end of the story, there's a YouTube link.
Yeah. Well, there's a $32 billion surplus, and the legislature can't commit to spending even a billion of that, maybe less, to install AC in all, according to the article, 73 prisons that don't have it? That's ridiculous, but it's par for the course for Republicans. They only want to spend money if it somehow dehumanizes someone. And I agree with you, Mike, that John Whitmire's response is shameful. I think if he hasn't taken it back since he said it in 2011, he has no business being trusted to do things he doesn't want to do as the mayor of the fourth largest city in the U.S., especially.
And really, it is important, and I don't know if Whitmire has changed his mind or retracted that statement.
Right.
I will say that from my own personal experience, when I am doing nothing, if I'm lying around or watching TV, I can tolerate 80 degrees. 85 would be a push. I would have to be really, really not doing anything at 80 degrees, 85 rather. So, you know, I'm imagining these people, many of whom are violent, some of whom are mentally ill, and that is a reason for their violence. And I'm just thinking to myself, the hotter it gets, the more violent they probably become, and the shorter tempered the guards probably become. Yep. And it just seems to me like maintaining a prison at a more moderate, humane temperature, it's not only more comfortable, it probably prevents violence.
Yeah.
It just seems to me, and which, by the way, may make it cheaper in the long run because it avoids lawsuits and medical bills and turnover, which it's expensive to train people for anything, let alone prison guard.
Yep.
So, yeah, lots of reasons why this is way past time to be fast-tracked, aside from just funded.
Yeah.
This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig at KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org, or you can download with Google Podcasts, and I recommend listening that way. It's the Google Podcasts are available from Android or the iPhone App Store, or by going to archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this and other shows. KPFT, Houston's community media with about 100 show titles, means that we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming, whether it's politics, music, or something else. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. You can pick your favorite show, perhaps ThinkWing, and the amount of your donation, large, smaller, in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift, Imagine Vanna here. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps too, and it's free. Okay, our next story is, can renewable energy save America's coal communities? This is from oilprice.com. As the world moves away from fossil fuels, communities that have long relied on coal, oil, and natural gas are becoming increasingly concerned about their future job prospects and revenue. In the U.S., President Biden is hopeful this won't happen if the right preparations for growth are made, and he is planning to bring wealth and green energy to coal communities to ensure they don't get left behind. The federal government plans to pump hundreds of millions of dollars into coal-rich regions to turn them into green energy hubs thanks to recent legislation. The Department of Energy, DOE, will manage the allocation of $450 million in funds from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, or BIL, designated for clean energy projects on former coal mine sites. Most of the funds will come from recent climate policies such as BIL, CHIPS, and the Science Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act. The IRA introduced a 30% tax credit for wind, solar, and other green energy projects, as well as an extra 10% to boost energy communities. Much of the funding is expected to support populations such as those in the coal-heavy Appalachian region that have been devastated in recent decades due to coal mine closures. The U.S. Deputy Treasury Secretary, Wally Adeyemo, said coal communities have the knowledge, infrastructure, resources, and know-how to play a leading role in the move to a clean energy economy. The U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm stated of the move that these projects could prove out the potential to reactivate or repurpose existing infrastructure, such as transmission lines, substations, and these projects could spur new economic development in these communities. Many of these investments will be allocated using results from an interagency working group study on revitalizing coal power communities through federal investments. The group identified 25 priority areas from West Virginia to Wyoming in 2021. To date, the working group has invested more than $14.1 billion in state funds for coal communities, helping to attract $7.4 billion in private funding. The green energy development will include projects such as solar farms, metals and minerals mining, battery factories, green hydrogen projects, and carbon capture and storage operations. The move is expected to support U.S. goals of cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030 and achieving net zero by 2050, as well as supporting communities that could otherwise be left behind in the transition unless action is taken now. Some successes include the transformation of the Massachusetts Brayton Point coal power plant into an offshore wind manufacturing facility. Companies investing in coal communities will be expected to hire locally and train workers in the skills needed to run green energy facilities. Energy firms will also be made to pay prevailing wages to ensure that workers are not losing out on the change. The White House emphasized the need to ensure the creation of good-paying jobs that provide a choice to join a union. Also, remediating mine and drilling lands and plant sites to address environmental degradation and secure the benefits workers have earned. One of the first projects to be launched is a study of ways to extract critical minerals such as lithium, copper, and nickel from coal mine waste streams, and this might also include some rare earth minerals. The DOE is providing $16 million in funding to West Virginia University and the University of North Dakota to conduct the research, which will support future developments at former coal sites. I might add that the advantage is also disposing of coal waste, which itself can be a hazardous thing to have around. The U.S. is steadily building its domestic mineral industry, as well as looking regionally for the other high-demand resources needed to support the green transition. Metals and minerals such as copper, and lithium are vital components in electric vehicles, as well as solar and wind farms. New climate policies and investments in the mining and manufacturing industries will help the U.S. shift its reliance away from China for these resources and strengthen its energy security. As the U.S. undergoes a green transition, there is a major concern amongst coal communities that they could be left behind. But recent climate policies and a move by President Biden to establish energy communities, prior mining regions that can be transformed into clean energy hubs, could be the answer. Developing green energy projects in those regions could provide vital work opportunities as fossil fuel operations close down, as well as bringing in revenue and maintaining the energy and economic security of the communities, and I imagine improving their living environment because of the toxic stuff that will not be taken from the ground and put into the air, and diseases such as black lung disease and silicosis and things like that. So, I mean, there are a lot of advantages here. The only drawback I see, potentially, is I know as people get into the late 40s, early 50s, they are harder to retrain. And yes, that will be a tough hurdle. But, yes, you know, with the will, if most of the community becomes prosperous, or at least becomes more prosperous, those people may also be able to find ways to earn a living until they can retire. Mm. So, Andrew?
Yes. Well, Coal, oil, and gas workers are an important part of every serious plan to fight global warming. For example, the Green New Deal, the original plan from the Green Party, includes skills training, public sector jobs, and income and benefits assistance for displaced workers. Helping these workers is both the right thing to do and makes a major economic shift like this possible by keeping these experienced, qualified workers in the labor force for new green jobs. I'm glad to see that the Democrats' imitation plan understands this as well. I think a key investment missing from the article is research into more efficient recycling. Lithium, copper, and nickel will definitely be important for new renewable electricity infrastructure, but mining them will have a much worse environmental impact than recycling old products for them. Extracting these metals from coal mine waste streams is a great idea, but the government should also fund research into better methods of recycling solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries, and use that new technology in publicly owned recycling centers. I'm also not thrilled about the mention of carbon capture technology, because that's really not a proven, a proven kind of technology. But, you know, there's no perfect legislation, really.
Well, so. I will hypothesize that if you're going to attempt carbon capture technology, a place where they have miles and miles of mines could be a good place to inject carbon dioxide.
Yeah, that would probably be a pretty good testing ground.
You know, make lemonade out of lemons, as they say. Mm. I agree that better recycling technology for all kinds of things, including cars, batteries, clothing, and plastics, would be great. In some cases, the tech exists, but it's more expensive than using virgin raw materials. Mm. An idea that I've had is something like a value-added tax, which they have those in Europe, but I would be applying them here toward the purpose of encouraging, for example, recycling into design. That would be a way of making recycling easier, and when a product that has been created at the end of its life is successfully recycled, the value-added taxes could be essentially recycled back into the businesses that have managed to do a good job. Hmm. It would also be nice if there was some public funding to encourage recycling to be designed into products. Europe has been encouraging this for a number of years now, where they build cars with the plan on this is how we're going to recycle the materials from the cars.
So the value-added taxes thing, I like where your thinking is on that. And I've actually seen VAT, because I lived in the UK for 4 years with my family. And how exactly do you think that would work for this kind of purpose?
Well, I mean, this is an idea that I tossed out that would actually have to be considered down to the details. But I guess in rough form, I would say you bring oil out of the ground. Mm-hmm. So now maybe there's some pollution. If you're mm-hmm. good at cleaning up the pollution, you get some of the value-added tax back for bringing the oil up because you were a good corporate citizen and kept it clean in the environment. Hmm. Then you might process that oil into other materials, gasoline, diesel, petrochemicals, various other things. And again, if you manage to do that with a minimum amount of waste, maybe you are better at recycling, maybe the carbon capture. Maybe you do less flaring of excess gas that at a particular point in a process you can't use. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that a process can be tweaked and advanced and made more sophisticated that saves energy, saves pollution. And in some instances, automatically by exactly the opposite result, saves money.
Sure.
And, you know, if you do a good job at that, then you pay less of a VAT tax.
Okay.
Then when it gets to the point where it's being made into plastic, well, the plastic has to be recycled. Now, I've said many times that profit is private, pollution is public. Mm-hmm. So if a plastic manufacturer can find a way to make their plastics more recyclable, that when they get them back, they can better reuse them, or if they develop a process that can turn more manufactured plastic into the equivalent of virgin raw material, there is a process apparently like this, but more expensive than the virgin material, then again, the VAT is a reward. The money that you've paid for potentially polluting comes back to you for having been a good corporate citizen and found ways to pollute less and recycle more. So, you know, something along those lines. It would obviously a lot of variations in flavors.
Right. So the VAT is paid for by the companies, by the producers of these materials. And then if they, you know, have done things that have benefited the environment or benefited you know, their environmental footprint, basically. They then get some of that, or if not all of it, back, depending on how much they've helped.
Correct. Some or all of that back. Now, the companies that are bad at it, of course, they'll be inclined to
pass those costs onto the consumer.
Onto the consumer, which puts them at a competitive disadvantage. So they have the additional incentive to try to do better so that they can sell for a more competitive price and still make a decent profit.
Interesting. And if the VAT is applied for some of those more expensive recycling technologies like that plastic technology that you mentioned, it might help recycled plastic compete with new plastic.
That would be a possibility.
Interesting.
That the VAT tax might be refunded to a plastic manufacturer if they decided to pay the premium price in order to use this re-virginized, if you want to call it that, plastic.
Yeah.
And getting back part or all of that VAT tax would help make up the difference in cost between the more expensive re-virginized material and the original virgin raw material.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think it's a sort of it's a benefit for the world that we currently live in. I don't think it's a magic bullet or anything, but I think it'd probably help.
Well, it has the virtue of working on natural greed in order to make money and doing it in a socially responsible way, which is a form of right regulation. You know, you don't overregulate, you don't underregulate, you regulate in a way that ultimately, whether they like it or not, between business and society is a win-win.
And keep your ears out for that, folks, because that's going to be making a resurgence in the next article.
Yeah, could well be. Okay, our last article, I believe, is going to be Can Big Oil Scale Geothermal by oilprice.com. The oil and gas industry is exploring the potential of geothermal energy to provide more clean energy and heating. While geothermal has the advantage of not being dependent on weather like other green sources, this form of energy has higher development costs and longer lead times than solar and wind power. Geothermal could, in theory, be a perfect fit for the oil and gas industry and drilling service providers. It involves subsurface resource mapping, exploration, and drilling. But major hurdles remain. Expensive drilling and development, subsurface drilling risks, the availability of drilling services, which often depends on the oil industry cycle, and weaker returns than oil and gas have all played a role in holding back geothermal energy development, despite the fact that there are many areas in the world with high potential. Iceland, for example, has the highest fraction of geothermal heat energy in the world. Geothermal energy is a renewable energy source because heat is continuously produced inside the earth. Unlike with solar and wind, geothermal does not depend on sun or wind. Still, despite decades of development, geothermal isn't that popular. As of the end of 2021, geothermal power generation accounted for 0.5% of total installed renewable power generation capacity worldwide. The share of geothermal in the U.S. is similarly low, although the U.S. boasts the world's largest geothermal installed capacity at 3.7 gigawatts. Geothermal power plants use steam turbines to generate electricity. Some major names in the oil and gas industry have recently increased efforts to tap that potential and to study advanced technologies for doing so. Now, again, here is where a green VAT tax, if you want to call it that, might be helpful. Because if it's relatively not as profitable, the VAT tax subsidy, which essentially is money they pay and get back, gives them an incentive to do more. For example, U.S. oil and gas supermajor Chevron announced in September a joint collaboration with Japan's Mitsui Oil Exploration Company Limited to explore the technical and commercial feasibility of advanced geothermal power generation in Japan. Notice it's a volcanic area is a place where they tend to have more geothermal. The collaboration will study geothermal resource potential across Japan and will evaluate the effectiveness of advanced closed-loop technology, or ACL technology, for a future joint pilot project in Japan. At the end of last year, Chevron announced a joint venture with Baseload Capital to develop geothermal projects in the U.S. Baker Hughes launched the geothermal energy consortium Wells to Watts, which aims to transform dry, non-productive geothermal wells and non-productive oil and gas wells into geothermal wells capable of generating renewable electrical power. Baker Hughes and SLB, SLB was formerly called Schlumberger, have been drilling geothermal wells for decades. SLB says that it has been part of 80% of the world's geothermal projects. A recent study of researchers at five Texas universities showed that the oil and gas industry could play a particularly important role in advancing new, more globally scalable applications that could expand the resource base of thermal energy. The International Renewable Energy Agency, or IRENA, warns that geothermal power generation projects have, on average, relatively high capital costs compared to hydropower, solar photovoltaics, and onshore wind due to the high development costs and very different risk profiles compared to other renewable power generation technologies in terms of both project and development and operation. The oil and gas industry could play a role in breakthroughs in advanced geothermal technology, but high costs and low returns may continue to be hurdles to mainstream geothermal energy generation. Andrew?
Well, I think the biggest obstacle to averting global warming has always been profit. Private industry won't save humanity from climate change because they only do what's profitable in money or control. If climate action was profitable, they'd have taken it by now. Only nonprofit, publicly owned, and worker-controlled organizations will do the things necessary to shift the world away from fossil fuels, regardless of whether the organizations benefit or not. I'm sure private industry could greatly help if they'd share their research and make necessary economic changes, but I don't think they will unless forced to by law, and I think the only parties interested in those laws are the Greens and other socialists. New public efforts seem much more politically viable in our current climate.
I'm not quite as anti-capitalist as Andrew, and I'm not quite as socialist, but I would
really?
Yeah, really. I'm a little socialist. I'm kind of capitalist. I'm mixed. But I could certainly agree that unbridled capitalism is demonstrably historically a very bad thing for everyone except the successful capitalists. Even the small capitalists suffer from big successful capitalists. I believe that a mixed socialist capitalist system at best is best depending on the balance. I certainly believe that companies must be what I call right regulated. In other words, regulated to the right degree, not over or under. There it is, both for their own benefit and for the public's. There is growing evidence that the oil companies knew about global warming caused by their products going back to at least the 1980s. That's just about the time that Ronald Reagan had Jimmy Carter's solar panels removed from the White House. Yes, you can look that up. There is more. Ironically, if there is an industry with the financial and physical resources to bring us to a green energy age, it's oil and gas companies. But it will take the right regulation and the right profit incentives to enlist their help in a serious way. Okay, I think that does it for us for today.
I think so.
You have been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, etc., etc., is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and look forward to speaking to you again next week. And if you have comments, send them to us. Take care. Have a good week.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. The craziest thing was believing that your dad knew everything. So as a dad, you felt like you had to know everything. You had to get everything right. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then, you know, it kind of starts to work itself out. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Oh, R&R, R&R, where are they?
Dad, snap out of it.
I'm calling the doctor.
Dr. Renfro's office.
I need the doctor now.
Okay, hold on, I'll put you through.
Heal a sick, raise a dead.
Dr. Renfro.
Doctor, it's my husband. He's in a trance. He keeps repeating R and R.
We get a lot of that. Go to your radio.
Is that a new treatment?
No, tune your radio to 90.1.
R&R, reassuring and reputable.
Oh, you saved my life. I dropped my radio and it went off. I feel so much better now.
R&R, 2 to 4 weekdays right here on KPFT.